So if you like that mantra, you want to do it again, I just want to say a few words about it. Some of you didn't get it quite right, and I want to make sure you go away with it correct in your mind. So there are four bits to it, four tunes, yeah. So the first one is a kind of an opening. Om Mani Deva Hui. It kind of introduces Amitabha, the Buddha, to you. Then the second one is only two notes. Om Mani Deva Hui. And it needs to be just two notes, yeah? Yeah. And it's, I feel that as a tender love towards him. It should be really tender and soft, almost like an echo. Om Mani Deva Hui. Yeah. And then the next one is a variation of that, and there are five notes in this one. Om Mani Deva Hui. Four notes. Yeah. So don't get those two muddled up. The second one is just two notes, and then the next one is a variation. And then the last one is a kind of song of praise in a way. Om Mani Deva Hui. And you can really go to town with that one, you know. Om Mani Deva. And there's a little grace note there. Don't know if you noticed it. Om Mani Deva Hui. Yeah. So that's the mantra if you want to go away and practice that. Okay. So, I've got to give a talk now. And, there is so much to say about the symbolism in these sutras. The overarching talk really is about the Pure Land or the Buddha field from Mahayana Buddhism. That's what I'm really going to talk about today. The idea of a Buddha field. Field in this sense is not a literal field. It's more like an electrical field. It's an area, and it's a really massive area. The Buddha field is a massive area. So what I'm going to do is tell you a little bit about the history of how the Buddha field came about in Buddhism, the idea of the Buddha field. And then I'm going to go into... You see, the Buddha field itself is a really massive symbol. But within the Buddha field, there are lots and lots of symbols within it. So you could say that the Buddha field itself is an overarching symbol within which are many, many multiple symbols. So what I thought I'd do is give you a little bit of history of how the idea of the Buddha field came about. And then I'll talk about the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha within the Buddha field. Yeah, and I'm just going to give you a little preview of Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, because you heard when I was reciting, didn't you? You heard me twice mention Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And I love that bit. See if I can find it. I took the bookmark out. Yeah, here we are, here we are. First of all, it comes when those birds, Hangsa geese, which are mythical birds, they don't exist in this world, Hangsa geese, curlews and peacocks. And they're singing. You know, they're doing what birds do, squawking, tweeting, whatever, away. But they're tweeting the Dharma, yeah? They're tweeting the five spiritual faculties, etc., to us. And when the beings in that land hear them, what happens? When they hear the song of these birds, the minds of the living beings there become absorbed by the Buddha. So their minds become absorbed, concentrated in the Buddha, absorbed by the Dharma, and absorbed by the Sangha. So you've got the three jewels there immediately. And they're heard from the birds. I'll say more about what that might mean later, if you remind me. I often say that in talks. I'll say more about this later and then I forget. So do remind me if I forget. And then it happens again. The Buddha, Dharma and Sangha comes again with sound. So you've got rows of palm trees, and on the palm trees are nets of small bells all over them. And when the wind blows the palm trees with the nets of small bells on them, countless hundreds of thousands of divine musical instruments make a delightful sound which soothes the mind. So you see, it's not just visual, it's also sound. You have to imagine hearing many, many hundreds of thousands of musical instruments making this beautiful sound, yeah? And as well as that, the rows of palm trees and the nets of small bells, they make a sound when the wind stirs them. Then it says, when the people there hear those sounds, they recollect the Buddha in their bodies. Isn't that interesting? They recollect the Buddha in their bodies, they recollect the Dharma in their bodies, and they recollect the Sangha in their bodies. I think that's really significant. So that these beings, they don't just hear the Buddha, the Dharma and Sangha and it just goes in the head kind of thing. It goes right in the whole of their bodies. They imbibe the whole of the Dharma, Buddha and Dharma and Sangha in their bodies. You're nodding away there. You like that,
yeah,
don't you?
Yeah. Really
it's great, isn't it? I love it too. Yeah, so Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, that's going to be the kind of theme that I'm going to try and keep this talk together with somehow. Hopefully I'll manage. So let me begin, as I said I would. I'm going to just tell you how this idea of the Buddha field came about. So we go right back to the Buddha. 2,500 years ago in India, a man born of two parents grew up. To cut a very long story short, he left home, he found some teachers, he practiced the spiritual life under those teachers. He left those teachers after a while, he went as far as he could with them. He eventually left, went into the jungle, sat down and gained enlightenment. That's a very, very short story of the Buddha's life. He gained enlightenment or awakening. And the rest of his life, about probably 40, 45 years, he was walking around India, talking, meeting people, telling them what he discovered, teaching them the Dharma. Yeah, that's how it all began. You probably know all that, don't you? Very simple, very simple. Very human, really. As time went on, people began to feel that the Buddha was more than human. Yeah, to do what he did on his own was extraordinary, remarkable. And they began to feel that he was more than human. When the Buddha was alive, when someone practiced his teaching so well that they too became enlightened, he would say, well, you're as enlightened as I am now. So now there are two of us, yeah? And then another one, now there are three of us. So there was no difference in enlightenment. The only difference was that the Buddha got there first. But that was the only difference. So enlightenment was in enlightenment. Time went by and people began to feel that somehow the Buddha was extra special. His enlightenment was an extra special enlightenment. So then you get this idea that the Buddha's enlightenment was more than the other people's enlightenment. And then they began to feel that somehow the Buddha's enlightenment was not just a human enlightenment, it was kind of cosmic. It was a cosmic event. And they had this idea that previously, many millions and trillions of years, even more than that ago, kalpas ago, now a kalpa, Kalpana will know what a kalpa is. A kalpa is an extremely long time. It's one of those periods of time which are so long that it's unimaginable. The texts give you an idea of how long a kalpa is when they say you have to imagine a massive piece of rock a mile square. And every 100 years, a goddess comes down from one of the heavens with a piece of Benares silk in her hand, and she just strokes that piece of rock with that Benares silk. Every 100 years she does that. So a kalpa is as long as it takes for that piece of rock to be ground down to nothing by that piece of Benares silk. So can you imagine that period of time? No, we can't imagine. It's unimaginable. It's what in Buddhism is called achintya, unimaginable, unthinkable period of time. So, unimaginable number of kalpas ago, before the Buddha, there was another Buddha, yeah, called something. And before him, unimaginable number of kalpas ago, there was another Buddha. And so on, way back seven times to another Buddha. And some traditions have more, some traditions have 13, 14 Buddhas. I think there might even be a tradition with 27 Buddhas way back. So our Buddha, what we now call our Buddha, Shakyamuni, who lived 2,500 years ago in India, now becomes the latest in a long line of Buddhas. Yeah, so he's not just the Buddha, he's a Buddha in a long line of Buddhas. So that was one development that came soon after the Buddha's death. But then there came about another idea that not only were there all these Buddhas back in time, but actually there were Buddhas now existing, not in this world system. A world system is an ancient Indian cosmological idea. Probably the nearest we can get to it is something like a galaxy. That doesn't quite, it's two very different systems, of course, scientific and mythical, but it's a world system. It's a very, very large area. And Buddhism has it that you can only get one Buddha per world system. One Buddha per world system. But there are many world systems out there, many, many world systems, an uncountable number of world systems. And some of them have Buddhas in them, yeah? And
shut up.
When you get a world system with a Buddha in it, it's called a Buddha field, yeah? A Buddha kshetra, yeah? So now you've got this idea of many world systems, including this one, and some of them with Buddhas in. And this one has got a Buddha in. And then they had this idea that there are basically two kinds of world system, two kinds of Buddha field. There are pure Buddha fields and impure Buddha fields. Yeah. We live in an impure Buddha field. Now, an impure Buddha field is characterized by dukkha, by suffering. Yeah. So that means we are in one, isn't it? Because we all suffer, don't we? I bet you all suffer in various ways. I don't know a single human being in this world who doesn't suffer in some way, either physically or mentally, emotionally, spiritually. Every one of us suffers in some ways. That's not to say there's no joy and happiness and love and community and so on, but everyone experiences suffering in this world. So it's an impure Buddha field. A pure Buddha field is characterized only by happiness. Yeah? That's a pure Buddha field. That's a very rough and ready guide to Buddhist cosmology there for you. So I just say all that just to introduce this idea of a Buddha field. So what I'm going to be talking about today is one of those Buddha fields, a pure Buddha field called Sukhavati. Yeah? So Sukha is happiness. Simply that, Sukha. It's the opposite of Dukkha. Dukkha is suffering, Sukha is happiness. Two opposites there. And whereas our impure Buddha field is characterized by suffering, a pure Buddha field is characterized by happiness. And this particular Buddha field is known as the realm of happiness. Or sometimes it's known as the realm of utmost happiness or bliss. And there's a whole myth around it about how it came about and so on. And I'm not going to tell you that, the whole, what I call the mythic history of that land, how it came about. Leave that to another time or read it in the book, third chapter. So I'm not going to say anything about that. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to just talk about this Buddha field. I'm going to just read you bits of the text so you get an idea what that, I've read you some of it already. So you get an idea of what it's like. And I'm going to suggest certain interpretations of those bits of the text that I read you. And as I say, I'm going to try and do it through talking about the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. So let's begin with the Buddha. So we've got the Buddha here in this world system. He's called Shakyamuni, as we know. I'm sure you know something about that Buddha. I'm not going to talk about him, except to say that according to these sutras, that Buddha, our Buddha, taught these sutras. He told people about these sutras. He described these sutras in great detail. According to these sutras, that's what happened. It's almost definitely he didn't. Yeah, almost definitely he didn't. But the sutras want us to think that he did. That's another story which I won't go into now. It's in the book. So let me begin by introducing him to you. That Buddha up there, which is a lovely applique picture of the Buddha Amitabha, who is the Buddha of this pure Buddha field Sukhavati. And he has two names. One of his names is Amitabha, and the other name is Amitayus. doesn't matter which one you use. He's used interchangeably throughout these sutras. Amita means boundless or measureless. Sometimes it's Amita is translated infinite or eternal, but I think, strictly speaking, it means measureless or boundless, which is quite an interesting idea, isn't it? When something is boundless or measureless, there are two ways you can understand that. You can understand it as being it's massive, so big that you can't measure it, or it's so subtle that you can't measure it. Yeah. How can you measure an emotion? How can you measure the depth of feeling in a song? Yeah. It's immeasurable. Think about your favourite piece of music. Yeah. How can you measure that? Your favourite poem. Is that measurable? Could you measure that on the scale of 1 to 10? Or it's a number 8 poem, that one. Some things are just immeasurable. They're outside of the sphere of measurement. That's the way I like to understand Amitabha and Amitayus, that they're beyond measurement. You can't measure them with anything. Yeah, not that they're so big that you can't measure them. That's one way of understanding it. But another way is that they're just beyond the realm of human measurement, categorization. Amita, boundless, measureless. This is a noisy centre, isn't it? Go away. We'll ignore them. Abha, A-B-H-A, means light. So Amitabha means measureless light, boundless light. And Amitayus means boundless or measureless life. Yeah. So you could understand that in terms of bigness, largeness, Amitabha's light. And the texts do say that his light spreads throughout all of the Buddha fields, all of the non-Buddha fields, pure and impure, throughout the whole universe. His light spreads throughout the whole universe. I'm now talking about the Buddha jewel, by the way. Yeah. So what might that mean for his light to spread throughout the whole of the universe? The way I understand that is that what he represents is the principle of Buddhahood, the principle of awakening, which is ever-present, no matter where you are, no matter what world you're in. In a way, no matter what state you're in, the possibility of awakening is present. Yeah, redemption is always possible, you could say, to use a Christian term. I really love that, because I think sometimes we imagine that, well, we do, don't we? The Buddhist tradition talks about a path leading to Buddhahood. And it can seem a very, very long path, can't it? Extremely long. And there is a path to Buddhahood, and you have to prepare yourself and so on. But I think sometimes we don't realise that it's also just around the corner. It's very, very close. Some of the ancient sages used to talk about that, didn't they? They used to say things like, oh, what a pity, you're looking for Buddhahood all over the place, you're travelling for miles, and it's right here. It's right here. So I think his light shining throughout the whole universe represents that awakening is ever present, ever a possibility, even when you're in a really bad state. Sometimes we kind of put off our enlightenment, our awakening, don't we? Because we're not in a good state at the moment. Oh, I'm in a really bad state. There's no way I can gain enlightenment right now. But that's just, we're limiting ourselves by our view about it. Actually, awakening is here, right now. If you just open your eyes, it's possible right now. No, not one. Maybe another time. Ayas means life. So he also represents measureless life. And sometimes, obviously, this can be understood literally as eternal life. But again, I like to understand it in a more subtle way, that life is ultimately unmeasurable. Yeah. There was a man, a young man, and I can't remember his name now, but he was quite well known before he died. He died in his early 20s or even in his teenage years of cancer. And he became famous just for a short while because he knew he was going to die of cancer, and he took it very, very positively, and he started up a charity. Do you know who I'm talking about?
I do, but I don't know.
Can't remember his name. But towards the end of his life, he wrote a blog. He's doing a lot of that, and he said, one of the things he said was, I can no longer see the point of measuring life in days, months, and years. Isn't that a tremendously wise thing to say? I can no longer see the point of measuring life in days, months, and years. But we do, don't we? We think of our life as going on in a linear fashion, days, months, and years. But that's only one way to understand it. I remember, Mozart died young, didn't he? Yeah. How old was he when he died, Mozart? Anybody know?
35.
Was he that young? 35. Yeah. And I was in a seminar with my teacher many years ago now, and somebody said, oh, Mozart died young. And he said, no, he didn't. He had a very, very full life. So, Amitabha is the Buddha. You could say he's the Buddha principle that shines throughout the whole universe. How are we doing for time? Can I say anything more about it? I'll read you some of the texts, actually. There are three so-called Pure Land sutras. Two of them are called Sukhavati Vyuha sutras, and one's short and one's long. So one's called the shorter Sukhavati Vyuha sutra, and the other's called the longer. The shorter one's about 6 pages, and that's the one I read to you earlier, and the longer is about 50 pages. And then there's a third, and nobody quite knows their provenance. Nobody quite knows where they were composed or when. But most scholars think around probably Pakistan. Here's an interesting thing. There's the so-called Pure Land Sutras. Do you know what Pakistan means?
Pure land.
Yeah, isn't that funny? That's not why Pakistan is called Pure Land, because of these texts, by any means. But it's just a strange coincidence. Probably in Pakistan somewhere, and probably about 1-200 Common Era. So about 500-600 years after the life of the Buddha. But then the third one is a few hundred years later, and as Ratnaprabha has suggested, it's probably a Chinese production. It says at the beginning of it that this sutra was translated from the Sanskrit by such and such a person in such and such a year. But probably they said that because it gives it more kudos if it comes from India, because that's where Buddhism comes from. But it's probably a Chinese composition. I'm going to read you from that sutra now, because that is the... It's called... We in our movement, know it as the Amitaya Jnana Sutra. But that is a Sanskrit term. And they're probably... It says it was translated from the Sanskrit, but probably the Sanskrit has never been found. So I prefer to call it its Chinese title. Actually, I can't call it the whole of its Chinese title. It's quite a long title, but its abbreviation is the Guan Jing. Now, Jing is sutra or text, and Guan means to look. It's the same as Guan Yin. You know Kuan Yin or Guan Yin? It's to see, to look. Therefore, to visualize. And also, therefore, to have insight. So it's often translated into English as either the Visualization Sutra or the Contemplation Sutra, or sometimes the Meditation Sutra. And after the story that Ratnaprabha told, the Buddha taught Vaidehi 16 visualizations or meditations. And I'm going to read you a little bit from one of them where the Buddha begins to tell her how to visualize the Buddha Amitabha. Just read you a little bit of that bit. When you have obtained a vision of these things, all the things he's taught her beforehand, you should then focus your mind on the Buddha. Why should you do this? The body of all the Buddhas, all the Tathagatas, is the realm of reality. And they enter into the focused minds of all living beings. Therefore, when you focus your mind on the Buddha, your mind takes on the 32 major physical characteristics and the 80 minor physical characteristics of the Buddha. Never mind that bit, it's a bit technical. When your mind creates the Buddha, your mind becomes the Buddha. The ocean of all the perfectly awakened Buddhas arises from the focused mind. Therefore, you should concentrate your attention with an integrated mind and visualize the Buddha, the Tathagata, the Arhat, the perfectly awakened Buddha, with great care. So he tells that to Vaidehi before he describes the Buddha, because he's telling her, why do it? Why visualize the Buddha? What is the point? And he's telling her the reason for doing that. So I'm just going to go into that a little bit, because I think it's rich with meaning. You should focus your mind on the Buddha. Why should you do this? The body of all the Buddhas, all the Tathagatas, that's another name for Buddha, Tathagata, is the realm of reality. Now that phrase, the realm of reality, in Chinese is fujie. There's no Chinese people here, so you don't... Oh! What do you think about that pronunciation, fujie? How would you say it? Oh, say it again. Oh, lovely. What's it mean?
Is Dharma.
Yeah. Great. Very good. So it's the Chinese equivalent of the Sanskrit Dharma Dhatu, which Sridharpa here translates as the realm of reality. And what that really means is everything is real. Yeah. This is very interesting that in Buddhism, you don't get this idea that everything is an illusion. Yeah. No, everything is real. It's your mind that's deluded, yeah? And what you have to do is open your eyes and see things as they are, because reality is here, right in front of you. Right in front of you. It's not somewhere else. It's not in a retreat centre. It's not somewhere in India or China. It's here, everywhere. Reality is all over the place. We're surrounded by reality, and we're in reality. We are reality. So the wisdom of the Dharma Dhatu. So what the Buddha says here is that the body of all the Buddhas, all the Tathagatas, is the realm of reality. They symbolize reality. And they, the Buddhas, enter into the focused minds of all living beings. That's to say, if those living beings focus their minds on the Buddha. So when you focus your mind on the Buddha, you know, when you go downstairs and you're sitting looking at that Buddha figure and you're focusing your mind on the Buddha, what's happening is that Buddha represents, symbolizes reality. And so when you really focus your mind on the Buddha, you can become the Buddha. Your mind can become the Buddha mind. That's how it works. Do you get that? Yeah. And then he talks about the 32 major physical characteristics and the 80 minor physical characteristics. That's a technical thing which we don't need to go into, because then he immediately tells you what that means in a non-technical language. When your mind creates the Buddha, your mind becomes the Buddha. When your mind creates the Buddha, your mind becomes the Buddha. So in visualization, what you do is, first of all, you look at a picture or a statue of the Buddha. You look. You close your eyes. You try to see that Buddha. You try to imagine, visualize that Buddha. And as you do that, your mind takes on all the characteristics, all the virtues of the Buddha. That's how it works. You bring the Buddha into your mind. Yeah? So then, there's quite a long passage of describing what the Buddha looks like, and I'm just going to read you one bit. If I can find it. Understand, Ananda. So the Buddha's talking to Ananda as well as Vaidehi. He's talking to Ananda because Ananda could remember everything the Buddha said, and the Buddha wanted him to remember. Understand, Ananda, that the colour of the body of the Buddha Amitāya is 100 quadrillion times more brilliant than gold from the Jambu River in the heaven of the Yama gods. Yeah. 100 quadrillion times more brilliant than gold in a heavenly realm. So that is really, really bright. And in another section of the of this sutra, it says that it's so bright that you're blinded. Yeah, you're blinded. You cannot see it. It's just it's overwhelming. Yeah. The height of the Buddha's body, right? The height. Now, I need to tell you a little about Indian, ancient Indian measurement. So a yojana is a very imprecise measurement, but often scholars think it's about 9 miles, yeah? So let's say a yojana is 9 miles. The height of the Buddha's body is a number of yojanas equal to the number of grains of sand in the river Ganges multiplied by 60 quintillion. Now you're laughing. And I think these sutras are not meant to be completely serious. Yeah? Yeah? They're not meant to. We don't realise when we read sutras that sometimes there's a joke. We don't get it because we're not expecting a joke in a Buddhist sutra. But I think the authors of these sutras are having a great time just imagining and then imagining more and more and more. A bit like children, you know, where they say, I love you as much as the sky. And then you have to sing even better, even bigger, don't you? I love you as much as the universe. It's a bit like that. They're just having a great time. A friend of mine once worked out exactly how big that is. How he did that, I don't know. But he worked out a yojana and then he said, well, how can you work out the grains of sand? How can you possibly measure that? Anyway, that is absolutely massive. So the Buddha is actually bigger than our galaxy. Yeah? He's bigger than our galaxy. It's absolutely massive. So big, you cannot possibly get him in your line of vision. Yeah. You'd have to go to another galaxy to see him in a telescope, yeah. So you have to imagine the Buddha so big that you cannot get him in your vision, yeah. What that means is you're in the Buddha, yeah. You're having your being in the body of the Buddha. You're living in the body of the Buddha. Now that is the symbolism of the sutra. That's what it actually means, yeah. Absolutely massive. So what that means is Buddha mind is everywhere. Buddha body, Buddha mind is the same thing, more or less. It's absolutely everywhere. It's the same idea that I mentioned earlier, but it's a different kind of symbol for that. That largeness. I quote a lovely section from a book about David Hockney in this book, where David Hockney is talking about the difference between what he calls physical sight and psychological sight, yeah? And he says, you all know the difference. You know, when I ask you to look at that picture, if you look at that picture now, that picture, although it physically just stays the same size, but when we look at it, it kind of becomes bigger in our mind, doesn't it? It takes on a bigger form. And when we stop looking at it and we look at something else, it goes, reverts back to its size. So in these sutras, size equals spiritual significance. So the lotuses that I read you earlier today, the lotuses were as big as cartwheels, yeah? That's in the smaller Sukhavati Viuha Sutra. That's nothing. Because in the longer Sukhavati Sutra, they end up being miles wide, absolutely miles wide. These lotuses, which are like 10, 15, 20, 30, 50 miles wide, lotuses that big. You know, everything becomes really big. And can you imagine what effect that has on you when you're in a very meditative state of mind? Very concentrated. You've done the mindfulness of breathing for a long time and you're really focused on your breath. And then someone reads you these kind of texts and it kind of opens your mind right out. Kind of blows your mind in a way. That's the reason for doing it. Okay, time's getting on, isn't it? Enough on the Buddha? I take that as a yes. So let's go on to the Dharma now. Now, I read you some of the Dharma earlier, didn't I? So it's very interesting that the Buddha, to stay with the Buddha for a bit longer, the Buddha Amitāya, it says in the text that he's in Sukhavati teaching the Dharma. And what does he teach? He doesn't say anything. He doesn't say anything. Yeah? The teachings don't come from him. The teachings come from the land. Yeah? The land is the Dharma. So you heard earlier that the birds, and they're magical birds, they're not birds like the birds we get here, they're magical birds. And they swoop down three times in the day, and they do what birds do. But what they're doing is they're singing the Dharma to you. And in the longer sutra, you get these rivers, and you can guess the rivers. They're not just like, you know, the River Thames. They're absolutely massive, you know, like 9, 10, 20, 30, 100, 50, 150 miles wide and 12 miles deep. And this massive body of water just coming down. And you listen. I'll read it to you, shall I? I'll read it to you. There were great rivers, as much as 20, 30, 40, or 50 yojanas across, and 12 yojanas deep. All of these rivers flow smoothly and with sweet-smelling, fragrant waters. As these waters flow forth, they carry within them great masses of flowers, encrusted with different kinds of precious substances, and they fill the air with delightful melodic sounds. Imagine, Ananda, that there were a musical instrument composed of countless hundreds of thousands of parts, and that this musical instrument was played with great skill, and accompanied by heavenly choirs, such that it created a sound that soothed the mind. That is what the sound of these great rivers is like. It is profound, ungraspable, unfathomable, and pure. It is a delight to hear, and it touches the heart. It is enchanting, delightful, and it soothes the mind. It is agreeable and appealing to listen to, murmuring, impermanence, peace, no self. It brings happiness to those who hear it, and it reaches the ears of all the living beings in that world system. So in the longer Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra, the Dharma is heard from the murmuring from the rivers. Yeah, impermanence, no self, peace. That's the only bit of conceptual Dharma teaching in the whole 50 pages of the sutra. Yeah, everything else is imagery. And in all this gorgeous, wonderful, beautiful imagery, you get these three words. Impermanence, peace, no self. And if you were daydreaming at that point, you've blown it. Yeah. Got to go right all the way to the end, and you've got to start all over at the beginning and wait until you get there. So 50 pages, that's the only bit of conceptual Dharma teaching. Yeah? They're symbolic texts. They're not conceptual texts. Yeah. So this is the only conceptual bit of Dharma in it, but everything is Dharma in it. Everything is symbolic. In another part, just after this actually, it talks about the beings there, how they can wade into the rivers. And it's up to them. They can wade up to their ankles, or up to their knees, or up to their hips, or up to their chests, or right up to their ears if they want to. Yeah. And the water can be warm or cool, depending on what they want. Yeah. Now, what does all that mean? One or two scholars I've read talk about it as being a realm of luxury, but I don't see it like that at all as a realm of luxury. Water imagery is meditation. Yeah, yeah. You know the Buddha's imagery of the four jhanas. It's all water imagery, isn't it? Water represents meditation. It represents higher states of consciousness. Those ponds that I was describing downstairs, yeah, the pure water of those ponds with those lotuses in. When I practice these meditations, I imagine myself going down one of those stairways, gold, silver, lapis lazuli, or quartz, one of them. On different days, I choose different ones, and I go down, and I just imagine that this pure water just goes into, covers my feet, then up to my knees, and so on, and then I get right up to here, so like this, and then I go, okay, here we go, down we go, right in it, and then I'm completely immersed in meditation, which is the world of imagination. The water for me symbolizes the purified, the awakened imagination. Yeah, that's what the water is. So when these beings, they can go into the water, you know, it doesn't mean really that they go into the water. It means that they can go into meditation at whatever depth they want to, yeah, at will. They can go into first jhana, they can go into second jhana, etc. Anything, they can just go in there whenever they want to and replenish themselves, purify themselves with meditation. Yeah, quarter past. Should I be finishing soon?
No.
So the land, the whole of the land is the Dharma. It's Samatha and it's Vipassana. The whole thing is Samatha and Vipassana. So that's the Dharma there. Finally, Sangha, the Sangha jewel. Sangha means community. In the shorter Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra, just after that bit that I read, just after where the Buddha describes, in not in detail at all, but a thumbnail sketch of Sukhavati to Shariputra, he then says to Shariputra, you should cultivate a heartfelt desire to be born there. Heartfelt desire. And then he says, why should you do this? Because when you're born there, you'll be with all the wonderful beings who live there. Yeah, that's the only reason he gives. That's the only incentive he gives for being born in Sukhavati. Not so you can play in the ponds and the rivers. Yeah, not so you can have jewel trees everywhere. Not the beauty of the land and so on. But because you'll be able to live with these tremendous beings who live there. It's a restatement of the Buddha's statement that spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. Yeah. Now, as I was saying that, I just looked over there at you and I remembered what you said about the land not being attractive. And I meant to say something about this, so I'm just going to backtrack before I talk about the Sangha, because I just want to talk about that. The land is not meant to be a land in the sense that this land is here. Yeah. Some people who really love the countryside, they listen to these jewel trees and they think, no, I don't want that. I like trees with bark, brown trees with bark and proper leaves on. You know, I like that. This land isn't like that. Yeah. The land of Sukhavati represents high states of consciousness. The jewel trees aren't really meant to be real trees. They're trees. I don't know if you've ever been on retreat, yeah, and you have what we call a good meditation. You're not supposed to call them good, are you? But you know, you have a really concentrated meditation. It really surprises you. You think, whoa, that was really good. And you don't want to come out of it at the end. You know, you're often of the bell goes, oh, thank goodness for that. That was a long meditation, but on this occasion you don't. The bell goes and you think, oh, to hell with that, I'm going to carry on meditating. And eventually you open your eyes and you come out of the shrine room and there are trees and grass and maybe a few flowers and you see them in a completely new way. Have you had that experience? Everything's like fresh. Everything's new, as if it's been newly minted, yeah? And it's so bright. So much brighter than you've ever seen it before. You think, what is that? Is that really grass? I've never seen grass like that before. You know that feeling? Have you had that feeling? Yeah? And sometimes, when you have that, you also feel that there's something more. There's something really significant in the experience. It's not just a lovely visual experience. There's something there. It's almost as if reality is trying to get through to you. Have you had that experience? If you could only just open up a bit more, you'd understand. Yeah? But you can't quite get there. Or maybe you did get there. Maybe you did. But I usually can't. This feeling of reality impinging on me, saying, wake up, you idiot. And I'm trying my hardest just to let it all in, but I can't quite realise the significance of it. That's what the descriptions of the land really mean. Yeah. So, back to the Sangha. So, the Buddha fields mean lots of things. They're symbols. Yeah, they can mean so many things. And one way of understanding the whole idea of Buddha fields is they're Sangha. They're symbols of Sangha, spiritual community. And in the longer Sukhavati-Viuha Sutra, there are a few pages of description of the beings who live there. And I'm going to finish off by reading some of this and saying a few words about it. The living beings in that Buddha field have no notion of ownership. As they walk about, wander around in that Buddha field, neither delight nor discontent arise in them. As they stroll across that Buddha field, they have no particular expectations. They are free of expectations. Those living beings simply do not think in that way. Moreover, Ananda, the living beings who have been born in that Buddha field, in Sukhavati, have no perception of anything as belonging to others, no perception of anything as belonging to themselves, no perception of inequality, no division, no conflict, and no hostility. They have minds of equality, minds of loving kindness, gentle minds, affectionate minds, diligent minds, clear minds, stable minds, unhindered minds, unshaken minds, unagitated minds, minds which practice the perfection of wisdom. Let's just stay with that, shall we? Throughout this sutra, there's a number of references to the beings in that Buddha field having no notion of ownership. Yeah, even to the point they don't even consider their own bodies as their own. Yeah, tremendous. It's not that they have a notion of ownership and they've renounced it, or they have a notion of ownership and they're not trying not to have that notion of ownership. They have no idea what ownership actually means. Yeah, there's a story, isn't there, of Columbus or somebody going to America and meeting up with the indigenous Indians there. And apparently the people who lived in that country had no notion of owning land. There's that story, isn't there, which I presume is true. And we're so used to notions of ownership. You know, who owns that bit of land over there? You know, that's my pen. Is that my... No, are you sure it's that your jumper? Oh, no, okay. So this idea of mine and yours, isn't there, that we all have. But in Sukhavati, it says they simply do not think in that way. They have no. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine a society where nobody owns anything? Not only that nobody doesn't own anything, but nobody has any idea that even could be a possibility in anybody's mind. There's no notion of ownership. Can you imagine not even having a sense of ownership about this bit of the universe here, your own body? Doesn't even belong to you. Yeah. That's really hard to imagine, isn't it? Really hard to imagine. One of the things I often say when I'm talking about this is we need to be a bit careful, because this is very, very exalted states of mind here. And it's unlikely that we in our impure world can quite get to where they've got to in their pure world. But I think of the description of the Sangha here as being a kind of blueprint, as being an ideal which we can always strive towards and never quite get there. But the closer we get to it, the better our society will be, the happier we will be. How are we doing for time? Do I need to stop soon?
Well, if you want some time for signing, you need to stop pressing.
Is anybody going to buy my book this evening? Because if you're not, I'll carry on. But if you are going to buy it, we'll have to stop soon and so that I can sign them for you. What do you think? No? Yeah. Okay, I'll just say a few more words about this section because it's so good, isn't it? It's absolutely wonderful. And I love the next bit. The living beings in that Buddha field have no notion of ownership. As they walk about, wander around in that Buddha field. I think that's lovely. It just suggests, just in their very wandering and walking about, that they don't own anything. Nothing is theirs. As they stroll across, they're strolling across that Buddha field, they have no particular expectations. Can you imagine living with no particular expectations? Yeah. So you come into a situation, you've got no expectations of it. You come to this evening and you don't know what's going to happen. Whatever happens is fine. Can you imagine living in that kind of way?
Is that basically enlightenment?
Well, they're well on the way to enlightenment, yeah. In a way, it's describing the enlightened mind, isn't it? It's something that we can aspire to, allow into our minds, yeah. And because of that, yeah, they have no perception of anything as belonging to others, no perception of anything as belonging to themselves, no perception of inequality. Yeah. Because there's no ownership, there's no inequality. Remember, they don't even own their own bodies. Yeah. There's no inequality. And therefore, no division. No division between people. No conflict. Because conflicts happen because of ownership, don't they? And no hostility. They have minds of equality. Minds of loving kindness. Gentle minds. Affectionate minds. Etc., etc. What the practice here is to imagine being like that, yeah? Just imagine being a person with no notion of ownership. And imagine a community of people, no inequality, yeah? Imagine being all the time with people with gentle minds. Isn't that a beautiful word? Phrase, gentle minds, mudu chitta, mudu, one of my favourite words, soft, gentle, tender, that's what mudu means, gentle minds, affectionate minds. Can we imagine living like that? And if we can imagine living like that, maybe we can bring that about in our actual lived lives, so that we actually bring that about in our sangha, our local sangha. Gentle minds, affectionate minds. Beautiful. No ownership. Yeah. I think I'd better stop, hadn't I? So I did everything I said I was going to do. Introduce Pure Lands to you. Buddha Fields is an overarching symbol. Within that symbol, lots of different symbols. Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Yeah, there we are.